bro shit. It's time for some gay bro shit. Get into a gay bro shit. Let's fuck with it, gay bro shit.
Hey, hi, hello, bros and hoes and theys and thems and everybody else. And this is Gay Bro Shit, a podcast where I put out episodes whenever I damn well feel like it. And you can call me Whey Protein because I can be consumed when and if you need me. And today we are going to be talking about the wild and underregulated world of dietary and sports supplements. And like so many things I cover on the show, this is a huge topic that could be an entire podcast in and of itself. Because as you probably all know by now, some of them work, but most of them are kind of trash, and some are even potentially harmful or even fatal. And per usual, this episode spiraled as I wrote it and became longer and longer and longer and longer. So bear with me today. Get it? Bear? I made a bear joke because I look like a bear. Anyway, in 2023, the supplement market was estimated at $68 billion, and it is projected to more than double to $163 billion in the next 10 years. And the U.S. alone accounts for a third of global sales, with $22.6 billion in sales in 2023. Now, supplements come in a myriad of forms and intended outcomes, so we are going to attempt to keep our focus narrowly on the ones that are used to enhance our workout performance and aesthetic results, because I know that that is what most of us are here for. So I'm going to go over the most popular, best promoted, and marketed fitness supplements and talk about which ones actually seem to have a benefit and are worth the money, and talk about which ones aren't useful. But first, I have to potentially bore you with the history of the industry and the state of regulation so we know how we got here. And what we discover is how damn hard it is to regulate even the dangerous ones, let alone the ones that are just ineffective bullshit. So buckle up, bitches. Of course, when we talk about history, we have to start with herbal medicine, and that is the use of local plants in a given area, which through centuries of learned knowledge and experimentation were passed down through the generations. And archaeological evidence for medicinal use of plants dates back 60,000 years, and written records date back 5,000 years. So essentially, we've always had this. From our modern science-based perspective, it can be easy to dismiss this type of medicine as ineffective, but many of these remedies were and are still effective, and there are also a number of modern medicines that are derived directly from herbal medicines as we learn to identify and isolate the active ingredients. For example, willow bark led to the development of aspirin. Cocoa leaves led to the development of anesthetics, and opium poppies led to the creation of painkillers. So we can't be dismissive of all herbal medicine, and indeed doing so would be very Eurocentric and colonial of us. And most cultures around the world still maintain a proud heritage of herbal, or what we sometimes call traditional medicine, that can be very effective. But it's when things start getting sold and produced on an industrial scale that things start to get pretty shady pretty quickly. In the Western world, this kicks off in the 1600s when newspapers begin advertising what are called patent medicines. And these are concoctions that promise to cure a variety of maladies, sometimes literally all of them. And the ingredients are secret or patent protected, hence the name. And aside from newspapers, these elixirs were sold by showmen in traveling medical shows, often accompanying touring circuses or other live entertainment. The salesmen would put on a spectacular show where they would use audience plants to demonstrate the effectiveness of their cure, and then skip town immediately before the poor suckers who bought the product discover it was useless and then could demand a refund, or worse, pillory them or kill them. In the United States, this type of fraudulent cure-all takes on the phrase snake oil. But as I learned from a great episode of the podcast Maintenance Phase, the truly wild thing is that snake oil exists and apparently actually works. Snake oil arrived in the U.S. with Chinese workers working on the Continental Railroad who would use this ointment on their joints. And we think this might have been effective because the particular type of snake use, which is native only to China, is extremely high in omega-3 fatty acids. From here, I will generously call them entrepreneurial white folks. They saw this genuine medicine and saw that it seemed to work and decided to start marketing fake versions using mineral oil and passing it off as rattlesnake or viper oil. So the phrase snake oil becomes shorthand for any type of fraudulent health product. We also saw that patent medicines increasingly contained ingredients like cannabis, cocaine, alcohol, laxatives, opium, and most horrifyingly of all, toward the late 1800s and early 1900s, we actually saw medicines that contained radioactive ingredients such as uranium and radium, and one such product, Radithor, was sold as late as 1932. Around the same time, we also saw increasing scrutiny of food safety, owing in part to the work of investigative journalists like Upton Sinclair, who exposed the unscrupulous and unsanitary practices of the meatpacking industry. So the same year that Sinclair's famous novel, The Jungle, was published in 1906, a public outcry resulted in the passing of the Pure Food and Drug Act, which was the first permanent piece of legislation regulating the purity of food and drugs. Initially, the U.S. Department of Agriculture was responsible for enforcing these new rules, but by 1927, this department was splintered off to become what is now called the Food and Drug Administration, or the FDA for short. Nevertheless, people were still selling radioactive beverages, mascara that could blind, and fraudulent cures for diseases like diabetes. So additional measures were necessary. And in 1938, we got the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. So for the first time, that meant that all products had to be shown to be generally safe before sale, and also that some medications would be available only via prescription from a doctor. That act, however, had a blind spot in that it did not address the sale of vitamins, minerals, and botanical ingredients, other than to stipulate that these products not list themselves as having dietary properties. In other words, vitamins and minerals and herbs could not say that they were food. Vitamins themselves had first been identified in the early 1900s, and by 1922, multivitamins were available for sale in the U.S., including some that promised relief from diverse problems such as pimples, constipation, nervousness, brain fog, and to loosen up accumulated bile. So basically, they were hawking cleanses 100 years ago. Things never change. Throughout the 20th century, Congress would attempt to refine the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Safety Act, with further legislation being passed in 1958, 1973, 1976, and 1990. But these successive acts were often contradictory when it came to supplements, and there were a number of legal cases over the years that brought the FDA's labeling requirements into contention with the first-degree right to free speech. So in the early 90s, they attempted to resolve this once and for all. However, the supplement industry saw this push towards greater regulation as a threat to their existence. So they began to spend a shit ton of money on a publicity campaign advocating against these regulations. At one point, they had a television campaign where federal agents invaded actor Mel Gibson's house and tried to take away his vitamin C tablets. Yes, this is a real ad, and you can look it up on YouTube. And this campaign worked. Congress received more letters in 6 months opposing supplement regulation than they received during the entirety of the Vietnam War opposing that conflict. So with the help of Utah Senator Orrin Hatch, remember that name, he will be coming back, the supplement industry hand-delivered a law to Congress called the Dietary Supplement and Health Education Act, which, contradictory to its name, obfuscated the health benefits of supplements. And this act put product safety into the hands of the manufacturers and removed the FDA. Under this law, the producers only need to show that they have followed good manufacturing practices and are not required to do any testing to verify the effectiveness or quality of their products. And when it comes to verifying good manufacturing processes, the FDA is hamstrung by both having a very small team of only 25 people assigned to supplements, but also the reality that supplement manufacturers are not required to register formally. So we do not even have an accurate number of how many manufacturers there are making supplements. Instead, the FDA can only inspect facilities they are aware of and focus on products that they've received specific complaints about. And the burden falls on the FDA to prove that the product is unsafe. And I watched a PBS Frontline episode from 2016 that highlighted two cases where a product was found to be unsafe. In the first case, a company out of New York State was found to be selling a vitamin B50 that contained anabolic steroids. And this was only discovered after female users began complaining about masculinization symptoms and users of all genders reported mood disturbances. It turns out the company marketing the product had subcontracted the manufacturing out to another company. And because that company reused equipment that had not been properly cleaned between product lines, the vitamins had been cross-contaminated with some male enhancement product that they were also manufacturing. And of course, I'm curious what male enhancement product this was that contained steroids, but we'll never know. And it was only after 6 months of frantic emails and phone calls to the FDA that the product was finally investigated. And disturbingly, the woman who owned the company marketing the product reports that when she was visited by two FDA representatives, she was told that simply, "We've received some concerns about one of your products, but don't worry because it hasn't killed anyone." The company then ended up voluntarily withdrawing the product from the market, but 36 users ended up suing the companies responsible, and we don't know the exact number of people affected. The Frontline special then highlights another case where a fat-burning product sold primarily in Hawaii was responsible for 56 cases of acute hepatitis, with many of these people ending up needing a liver transplant and the eventual deaths of three people. In this case, it was the state of Hawaii that intervened long before the FDA to get the product withdrawn from sale. Of course, the person who was leading the FDA supplement department at the time then moved on to be an industry spokesperson for the supplement industry, and a classic case of the regulator becoming a highly paid industry insider once their assignment ends. It happens in finance, it happens in obviously medicine, but happens in all kinds of regulatory environments where somebody who works for an official regulator then kind of puts in their time with the regulator and then at the end of their stint cashes in for a much higher pay job as an industry insider. So if you want more evidence of that, look up what happens in the Federal Reserve Bank. But in spite of the apparent dangers of supplements, a majority of Americans surveyed responded that they thought supplements were either safe or completely safe. And it's also true that a majority of Americans think that whatever they're taking matches exactly what is on the label. And one would assume this to be true. However, in 2015, New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman did an investigation where him and his department bought supplements from multiple locations of four chain stores, Walmart, Target, GNC, and Walgreens, and conducted a DNA analysis to see if the plants in the pills matched those on the labels. Here's what they found. At GNC, they bought 24 bottles and made 120 separate DNA tests, and only 22% of these tests matched the genetic profile of the plants on the label. The 90 tests run from samples purchased at Target fared a little better, with 41% of the ingredients matching. Walgreens, however, fared worse, with only 18% of the 90 tests conducted showing matching DNA. Finally, Walmart had an abysmal record of only 4% of the DNA matching. And at each store, they found contaminants such as rice, wheat, daisy, spruce, clover, mustard, and even common houseplants. And as a result of this investigation, GNC and the other companies such as the vitamin maker Nature Made have agreed to start providing DNA barcoding for their products so that you can apparently verify that the ingredients on the label match those in the bottle. And I don't fully understand how DNA barcoding works, and I'm sure it's an imperfect system, but it still might be a good idea to look for supplements that have this labeling or this feature. Now, sometimes the supplements are exactly what they say they are, and they even work too well, perhaps. The most notorious supplement of the modern age is a Chinese herbal medicine called Ma Huang, which was marketed in the West as ephedra. While this plant has been used in traditional medicine for thousands of years in China, India, and the Americas, in the West, it was marketed as a weight loss drug. And the evidence suggests it is somewhat effective for weight loss, but only a modest 1.3 pounds of weight loss per month over a placebo. And when combined with caffeine, it was a bit more effective at 2.2 pounds lost every month. However, these studies only lasted for 4 months, so we don't have any long-term evidence of effectiveness. And most likely, somebody is going to need to continue taking it for many months to see visible results, because we know you generally need to lose like 10 plus pounds for that results to be visually apparent to other people. Meanwhile, it's relatively easy to lose twice this much weight in a month via a mild caloric deficit of 500 calories a day. Listen to episode 2 if you're curious about that. And in the 90s, this drug was everywhere. Up to 12 million people reported using it. And I still vividly recall the Hydroxycut and Trim Spa commercials that regularly played on Keville TV. Most particularly, I remember the Anna Nicole Smith ads where she asked us point blank, "Do you want a Viper, baby? Want some money, baby? Trim Spa, baby?" But of course, with this many people taking something that wasn't properly studied, there was bound to be a lot of negative side effects. And indeed, tens of thousands of reports were made of adverse reactions from mild mood disturbances, insomnia, headaches, dizziness, trembling, dehydration, itchy skin and heart arrhythmia, seizures, strokes, and death. And not just one or two deaths. Over 150 deaths were reported to the FDA before the substance was eventually banned in 2004. And it took the high-profile death of a Major League Baseball player using the substance to finally get enough attention to the matter to get the drug banned outright. And prior to this death, the supplement industry heavily pushed back against the ban, with our old friend, Utah Senator Orrin Hatch, saying literally that there was not enough evidence to support the ban. So you might ask why Orrin Hatch was so invested in the supplement industry. And that's because his home state, Utah, was and still is the center of the U.S. supplement industry, with as much as a third of all supplements sold in the U.S. coming from Utah-based companies. And Orrin Hatch's son was employed as a lobbyist by the supplement industry during the time that he was saying there wasn't enough evidence to ban ephedra. So people in his family were literally getting a financial incentive. So, of course, his opinion is going to be biased. And one of the super predatory aspects of the supplement industry based in Utah is the prevalence of MLMs or multi-level marketing companies. And if you're not familiar with MLMs, these businesses sell directly to consumers via independent representatives, and you typically can't buy their products in any sort of retail outlet. Not always, but typically. But the way that MLMs work is that in order to make money, you need to recruit other people into selling for the business, and you create a downline of salespeople who each give a cut of their sales upwards in the shape of a giant pyramid. But wait, it may be shaped like a pyramid, but it's not a pyramid scheme, because MLMs are selling physical products, most of which are overpriced and ineffective, but a physical product exists. And that's the key differentiator there between an MLM and a pyramid scheme. But in order to sell products for an MLM, you are required to order a minimum value of product per month to maintain your status as a salesperson. And it's, as a result, something like 93% of MLM salespeople lose money. In a true pyramid scheme, more than half of all participants actually make their money back, so an MLM is significantly worse financially. But Mormon culture, particularly because of the patriarchal rules about what roles women are allowed to have, has fostered an environment of Mormon wives participating in MLMs, which are often selling supplements or essential oils. And I've seen some leaked team meetings where these ladies are encouraged to reach out to recently diagnosed cancer patients to shill their products. And if it's not clear already, I need to state unequivocally that cancer can't be treated naturally, not by supplements, not by fasting, not by CBD, not by essential oils, not by crystals. Should you face a cancer diagnosis in your lifetime, it's totally up to you if you wish to seek treatment or not, and it's totally valid to not. But just know that there will be people looking to prey upon you when you are at your most vulnerable, which is, of course, disgusting. Another cult-adjacent community obsessed with selling supplements is the fitness industry and fitness influencers. And it seems like once a hot person on the internet reaches a certain follower count, a link to a supplement company almost always appears in their bios. Naturally, they receive a cut of any sales generated using this link. Or if the influencer really has enough clout, they might go ahead and just start their own supplement company. And in this case, the manufacturing of the product is always farmed out to a third party. And this new influencer-led company is basically just a branding and marketing operation, one that typically charges a premium for products of comparable quality and effectiveness. And we know the regulatory landscape is easy to navigate because they don't need to register the company or the products and do not need to provide proof of safety or effectiveness. And of course, this can be very misleading because we see these images of super fit people, and it's a convenient jump to think that taking whatever supplements they're advertising will make you look more like them. And we conveniently ignore the intense diet and lifestyle these people usually have, their superior genetics, their drug usage, etc. But some supplements actually do work and will help to slowly transform your body. So knowing what actually does work can save you a lot of money and aggravation. But know that regardless of what you take or don't, the process of fitness, specifically with an aesthetic outcome in mind, is always going to be one of being highly consistent over a long period of time. Giving 80 to 90% effort for years is what it's going to take, and you have to submit to that process, and that is slow. And often the growth is imperceptible, but that is what you need to submit to in order to be successful. So now let's talk about specific supplements in more detail so I can try and help you figure out which ones are worth taking or not. And by all means, I'm not going to cover every single ingredient available, and there are many things I'm not covering today that do work and have value, and many more that don't work, but that would take months to go over all of them. So I'm going to narrowly focus on the supplements that are pushed by the fitness world. And I'm going to start by covering the ones that have solid evidence for effectiveness. And then I'll move on to the ones that have mixed evidence. And finally, the ones that don't work and are even dangerous. And as per usual, I will be citing research. So you hopefully understand that I'm not just pulling this out of my gaping asshole. And show notes with the links to the resources are always available on this podcast website. All right, let's start and talk about which ones actually work, or there's solid evidence for at least. The first supplement that actually seems to work that we are going to talk about is everyone's favorite workplace crutch, caffeine. And the overly simple explanation of how caffeine works is that rather than speed up the heart rate directly like other stimulants, it blocks the reception of the chemicals that make you feel tired or fatigued. So the performance boosting benefit is probably derived by making you feel less tired and being able to better just power through. And caffeine is also very well studied, and admittedly at times the results can be mixed depending on the methodology and the hypothesis being tested, but in general it seems to have a positive impact on aerobic endurance. In most studies on cyclists and runners, times improved in those who supplemented with caffeine. Now, as far as strength is concerned, the results were more mixed. However, and this is a big however, it seems like when they look at people who already regularly consume caffeine, the impact of a caffeine supplement before a workout leads to better performance. But if a person does not regularly consume caffeine, then the results might be negative even. So in short, if you already consume caffeine, having a coffee or an energy drink 30 to 60 minutes before a workout will probably be helpful for you, if nothing else, so that you feel less fatigued and more apt to complete the workout that you had planned to do. Next, we're going to talk about pre-workout. And in the same vein as caffeine, a pre-workout supplement can be helpful for people. And the main reason for this is that most pre-workouts contain caffeine. But there are also other ingredients as well, typically L-carnitine and beta-alanine, which are both naturally occurring amino acids, which help with muscular endurance and the conversion of fat into energy. And one study I found showed about a 10 to 20% improvement in strength and endurance, meaning participants were able to do up to 20% more work after taking the pre-workout. And since volume is the number one determinant of muscle growth, that means you can potentially grow faster using pre-workout just because you're able to do more work. Of course, some people do not respond well to pre-workout, and I've gotten used to it now, but usually about 10 minutes after ingesting it, I get the sensation like there are pop rocks on my skin. And this is pretty alarming the first time you experience it. And so if you find caffeine makes you anxious, then pre-workout is definitely not for you. Also, because it has caffeine, you probably want to wait 2 or 3 hours after your last coffee or energy drink before consuming pre-workout, or else you're going to feel really cracked out and sweaty. And maybe that's fun for you, but it's definitely not for me. But now comes a giant caveat with pre-workout, and that is a lot of pre-workouts contain other substances which are not currently legal. In a 2017 study, 10% of the supplements tested were found to contain banned stimulants. And then in another notorious example, some pre-workouts have been found to contain methamphetamine analogs, which are chemicals with slightly differing structures, which act on the same receptors in the body. So third-party testing is critical in your pre-workouts, and I'll get back to that at the end of the episode. The next reliable friend we'll cover is creatine monohydrate. It's a fitness bro trope at this point that we all need to be taking 10 milligrams a day for life, but it turns out there is decent evidence for this. A meta-review that looked at 10 different studies found an aggregated improvement of skeletal muscle mass of about 11% versus not taking anything. Now, 11% doesn't really sound like much, and it's certainly not going to radically transform your body, but it is enough to be visibly perceptible in a side-by-side comparison. Furthermore, in younger people, the result was closer to 17%. So if you're starting out, the difference might even be more significant. And when you start taking it, you will probably see an immediate jump in scale weight because creatine causes more water to be stored in the muscles, which makes them look fuller. And unless you're competing in a bodybuilding show, you probably want to look as full as possible, even if maybe you look a little bit puffy. One note here for my fellow prep takers is that one of the blood tests they run to make sure that prep isn't negatively impacting your kidney function is creatine. So this test will be artificially higher than normal and may flag as a concern for your provider. So it might be best to take a break for a few weeks ahead of time with any prep blood work so that you get a truly representative number of kidney function there. There is also some early evidence that long-term creatine use may improve brain function and memory, so it could be that creatine may be somewhat preventative of dementia. We don't have enough evidence yet, or you could damn well bet we would have heard it recommended to everyone by now. All right, now let's talk about the granddad of all supplements, protein powder. And to assess protein quality, we use a metric called bioavailability, which essentially says what amount of the protein consumed is actually useful by the body for rebuilding. It's more complicated than that, of course, but that's the simplified version. And on this scale, eggs score a perfect 100, meaning they are completely bioavailable. Moving down the scale, cow's milk scores a 91, fish scores an 83, beef scores an 80, and chicken a 79. And even further down, we have soy at 59, wheat at 54, and beans at only 49. So while these plants contain a lot of protein, like, look at the protein content on pasta and just be surprised by it. You need to eat twice as much of them in order to get the same usefulness to your body. Now, these plants have other benefits that make up for their lack of protein bioavailability. So I'm not telling you not to eat them. Just take this into consideration if you're counting macros and count these protein sources as half credit. The great news is, though, that when isolated, milk, soy, and pea proteins all score nearly 100 on the bioavailability index. So it's super easy to supplement your protein needs with protein powders. For vegans and vegetarians, pea protein is pretty ideal, though not super great tasting. Soy protein tastes a bit better, and in spite of the popular misconception that consuming it causes estrogen levels to rise, you would have to consume multiple times what any human reasonably ever would to see a notable difference in estrogen levels. And then for those of us who eat animal products, whey and casein are cheap and effective. And whey is known for its rapid absorption, which makes it ideal for post-workout refueling, whereas casein has a slower absorption time and is ideal for a before-bed shake. Concentrated egg protein is also available for people who can't tolerate dairy or eat it for whatever reason, but it tends to be a bit more expensive than whey protein, which you can usually buy for less than $1 per ounce online. And while we're at it, I need to tell you that there's zero difference between higher-end grass-fed whey and cheaper brands. The key to assessing the quality of your protein powder is to buy one with the amino acid profile listed on the package. And then what you're going to do is total up the three branched-chain aminos, which are leucine, isoleucine, and valine, and make sure that these equal to between 27 and 30% of the total grams in a serving of that powder. So a 30 gram scoop of whey should have between 8 and 9 grams of these three BCAAs total. And if the amino acid profile isn't listed on the package, then don't buy that protein. As far as how much you need, well, that's really going to depend on how big you are and how much protein you're able to get from whole foods, such as eggs or meat. For me, I eat whole proteins 2 to 3 times a day, and then protein supplements twice more just to make sure I'm hitting my targets for the day, because it's just so much easier to chug a protein shake than it is to sit around and chew chicken breasts. And some people will tell you this is bad, but the science suggests that protein powders are maybe even better for you than food is, at least on the bioavailability index. On the same note, some people will say that you need to get your carbohydrates from whole sources like fruits and vegetables and whole grains, but this is also not true at all. Once carbs are broken down by the body, it has no way to distinguish if the carbs in the bloodstream come from brown rice or from Gatorade, for example. Now, whole grains have other positive things about them, like fiber and micronutrients that make it worthwhile to consume. But here again, I'm going to tell you that there's nothing wrong with consuming carbs in the form of a sports drink or a mass gainer shake if that's what you need to get enough to fuel you. So particularly during an intense workout session where the glucose in your muscles is rapidly depleted, anything where your heart is up near the top of its maximum rage, consuming a sports drink with dextrose or other simple sugars is going to enable you to continue performing for longer. if I have to play 80 minutes of rugby, I'm damn sure going to want some sugar in the middle of the match to keep my muscle glycogen stores where they need to be to tackle and sprint and drive people. And as I've said before, if you're a person like me who has trouble physically consuming enough food to meet your needs, so it has gotten a little bit better recently, then a mass gainer powder that has carbs and protein in it can be a great option. Don't expect the mass gainer to do anything that real food wouldn't do, but if it's what you need to consume in order to meet your energy targets, then it's totally fine. And I buy a product called Clean Gainer that has carbs from a mix of sources, and I've been using it for almost a year now, and it's honestly made a huge difference to my ability to eat sufficient quantity of food to grow. So now let's move on and talk about these supplements that may or may not have any benefit, meaning some studies show a positive result and others do not. So we've already talked about BCAAs or branched chain amino acids, but we're going to talk about them again. The body has 20 different amino acids, 9 of which are considered essential, meaning your body cannot make these and they must be consumed in food. But 3 in particular, the branched chain aminos, are considered the building blocks for skeletal muscle. So for a long time, I and many other people were taking BCAAs on their own and thinking they would promote tissue growth and repair. But it turns out taking BCAAs on their own have no impact on muscle growth. However, more recently, evidence has emerged that if you consume all 9 essential amino acids, either directly before or during a workout, then that increases anabolic activity. So particularly if you're working out fasted or in a low-carb state, consuming up to 18 grams of EAAs before and during a workout may improve your results. I suspect we'll start seeing more studies into this area in the coming years, so stay tuned. Okay, the next fickle friend we're going to talk about is vitamin D, which is naturally produced by our bodies when our skin is exposed to sunlight. And over the past years, vitamin D has been said to do any number of things, including boosting your immune system, reducing anxiety and depression, promoting bone health, reducing inflammation, and even inhibiting the growth of cancer cells. Problematically, in large human trials, none of these benefits have actually presented itself. The only benefit seems to be an improvement in bone health in people who are actually deficient already, and a modest reduction in mortality of cancer patients. And that's it. So don't believe the hype on this one. Now, many people are still deficient, so this is one of those where I think taking vitamin D may still be beneficial, but it's not going to have a radical positive impact. I still take it daily because I live in a northern city where it's dark and cloudy half the year, and it's also hard to take too much of it. So take this if you want. On a related note, we should be suspicious of multivitamins in general. Now, theoretically, we should be able to get all the vitamins and minerals we need directly from food. And by my math, this could be totally wrong, but I just did some number crunching, thanks to the internet, to get enough of the main vitamins A, B, C, and D and their subtypes, every day we would need to eat 1 entire sweet potato, 1 cup of egg whites, 2 salmon fillets, 1 chicken breast, 1 handful of almonds, and 1 cup of broccoli. So for your average bodybuilder diet, you're probably already getting your vitamins. So if you're eating mostly whole foods, you're going to be fine. But just like vitamin D, I don't think taking a multivitamin is actively harmful, but there are no long-term studies showing any significant health benefits. But it is possible to take too much of certain micronutrients, so be sure that the daily dose listed on the package doesn't wildly exceed the recommended dose for an adult. So if you see something that says like 1,000% of the recommended IDUs, then maybe don't take that multivitamin. So the last one I'm going to talk about in this category is fish oil. Now, there is evidence that omega-3 fatty acids contained in fish oil lower heart attack risks and improve joint pain in people with arthritis. And I personally take this because being on testosterone, which normally reduces your HDL cholesterol, I want to try and keep that up. So I'm taking it to attempt to do that. Problem with fish oil is that a lot of supplements you can buy are not of good quality. The PBS special that I watched cut a bunch of tablets open and discovered the oil inside was all rancid smelling. So the quality of the supplement probably makes a huge difference. The oil needs to be captured immediately when the fish is processed to keep it fresh. And so many product lines just aren't doing this. So I actually recommend cutting open one of your gel caps and smelling the oil inside. So if it smells rancid, then that's probably not doing you any good. But I also just recommend maybe eating more oily fish instead if that's something you can and want to do. All right, now let's move on and talk about these supplements being sold that are literally fishy, meaning there's no evidence that they work at all. Or in some cases, there is evidence, but it's not in humans, or there's evidence that's entirely misleading and contradictory. Now, if I tried to go over every ingredient marketed, I would be here for 10 hours. So I'm going to only cover the ones that I regularly see marketed in the fitness space. The first one I'm going to cover is adaptogens. Now, these are chemicals that supposedly help the body react to stress and protect the body from the damage caused by stress, particularly oxidative stress. And this sounds great in theory. And indeed, there have been studies that shown that they can be effective in this regard. But all of these studies have been performed on rats, and we are not rats. And the trials done on humans have been inconclusive or used a very small sample size. So this is definitely a don't believe the hype situation, in that adaptogens may still be found to be beneficial in the future, but at the moment there is no evidence. Additionally, some of these substances promoted as adaptogens have been shown to have harmful effects, including inducing abortions, which is probably not an issue for most of you, but just be mindful of that. Are the next big category of shit that doesn't work I'm going to talk about, and I'm lumping these all together intentionally, are products sold as either testosterone boosters or legal steroids. And I'm grouping these together because I looked at many of the product labels and found a bunch of common ingredients, and I figured it was worth going through all of these ingredients individually. Now, before 2004, when they were banned, many muscle-boosting supplements contained substances called prohormones, which converted to or acted like anabolic steroids in the body. And in fact, one study from 2004 looked at over 600 supplements labeled as non-hormonal and found that 14.8% tested positive for anabolic agents. Then after the 2004 Anabolic Steroid Control Act, which you've already talked about in a previous episode, this number dropped to only 0.7%. But it is safe to assume that some of these products actually do contain steroids, and we know that from the vitamin contamination case in York I already mentioned, and so this is still happening sometimes. Another common adulterant found in these supplements is sildenafil, which I'm not sure if I said that right, but that's Viagra. And one study of FDA complaints found that this ingredient was in 166 different supplements. While Viagra on its own is generally safe, it can be harmful when combined with other ingredients such as vasodilators like poppers. And this same study also found that 269 supplements that people complained about contained steroids or steroid precursors. The most common substance found these days is estrogen, which is a SARM or selective androgen receptor, which is basically a synthetic steroid. Again, we've talked about this in a previous episode. So contamination is certainly a big risk from this category of supplements. But let's just look at the ingredients that are actually on the labels. And again, I looked at a bunch of supplement labels and wrote down all the active ingredients and looked up each one of them. And it took a while, not gonna lie. Now, a lot of these products contain amino acids, which don't do anything to build muscle mass or raise testosterone when they are isolated. Many also contain other things like nettle, turmeric, ginseng, or ginger, which are said to be anti-inflammatory but have no benefits on muscle growth or testosterone levels. So then I looked at the ingredients that supposedly raise testosterone levels, and I found 12, which I'm going to talk about individually. And don't worry, as I go through them, the detail gets less and less and less. So it's not going to be as painful as it sounds. So the first one I'm going to talk about is ashwagandha. And this is a shrub that grows in Southeast and West Asia and Africa and has been marketed as an adaptogen. So there's that again. But in humans, there has been one study that gave men a 300 milligram daily dose for 8 weeks and looked at the effects on blood testosterone levels. So in this study, the mean testosterone level of participants given the substance rose from 403 to 477. So an increase of 18%, which sounds great, but is it really? Well, going back to the testosterone episode, basically, if someone is in the normal reference range for testosterone, that is in the 300 to 800 range, they're not going to feel a noticeable improvement in body composition, sexual function, energy, etc., unless they raise their levels up to the top of the reference range. So, if the mean testosterone level were raised to from, let's say, 400 to 700, then that would be an impressive and impactful difference. But the reality is that most people aren't going to notice any perceivable effects from an 18% increase in testosterone levels. Compare that to a medication like Clomid, which can literally double your blood levels, and you can see why you're better off just going with the actual medication. And this is a big point here to be made when we look at studies, because studies only need to show a change beyond what could be achieved by random chance to be labeled statistically significant. So what happens when there's a study that shows a statistically significant improvement, like 18%, is that someone then takes that top line finding and then writes an article that changes the words to, that changes the wording to something like, quote unquote, this substance is proven to raise testosterone levels significantly. And while that is technically true, it is misleading because the conventional usage of the word significant is different than the scientific usage. But most of us will just stop at this headline rather than going and looking up the original study and learning what the results might mean on an applicable level. And the supplement industry relies on our innate laziness to build hype around the effectiveness of a product, and this will be a big theme with these ingredients. Next one we're going to talk about is called Nigella sativa. It sounds like something else, but it's not. Also known as black cumin seed, and I was able to find a study that showed when taken as a powder, it nearly doubled the testosterone levels of the subjects. However, the subject in the study were albino rats who had medically induced diabetes. So this is the other pattern that emerges when we look at these ingredients that are said to be quote unquote proven, is that the proof is often studies done on rodents and rodents with very specific circumstances. And I guarantee that none of you listening to this are an albino rat with diabetes. So therefore, we can't possibly say if this one or any of the others might boost your testosterone. And in the few human studies we have done, there has been no observable change in testosterone levels. Our next suspect is DHEA. I'm not going to attempt to pronounce the full chemical name, but it is also sold as androstenolone or prasterone. And this chemical is a steroid precursor, meaning your body can convert it into a steroid like testosterone or DHT. And it is made in the body naturally. And just like ashwagandha, studies do show that taking it can raise blood testosterone levels, but only by a comparatively small amount. In a meta review of 42 studies, the average blood level increase was 28. So just a reminder, the normal range is something like 300 to 800. So if you were at the lower end of this range, if your testosterone blood level was 300 and you raised it by 28, that would still only be a 10% improvement. DHEA does have some negative side effects that we need to be aware of, including the fact that it also converts to estrogen, so it can lead to gynecomastia and other estrogenic symptoms, but it also negatively interacts with certain antipsychotic and bipolar meds, and when taken with SSRIs, which are the most common type of antidepressants, can induce manic episodes. Fun. All right, next One we're going to talk about is gamma oryzanol, and this is a chemical that is found in rice and wheat bran. So if you see either of these ingredients listed, it's because they're trying to introduce this particular substance. And in the case of this chemical, some studies show an improvement in muscle strength after taking it for several months, and theoretically adding more muscle strength should also lead to more tissue growth. However, other studies have also shown no increase in strength. So this is a case where, unless the studies overwhelmingly say it does something, then we need to assume it probably does not actually do that thing. Next up, we're going to talk about beta-sitosterol. And this is also found in rice bran, but also vegetable fats. And in plants, this chemical acts like cholesterol does in the human body. And cholesterol is one of the chemicals that gets converted into hormones, such as testosterone. However, in humans, beta-sitosterol doesn't actually convert to cholesterol, so it can't possibly convert into testosterone. Next, fenugreek. This is probably one of the most popular natural testosterone boosters, and I was able to find two studies that did show an increase in testosterone levels that would be considered statistically significant. But yet again, when I pulled up the actual data, the increase was a little less than 10%, and both of these studies were funded by companies which market the ingredient. Meanwhile, two other studies showed no significant impact on blood hormone levels. So here again, we have mixed results, and when the results are positive, they are entirely underwhelming and suspicious because of who's paying for the research. Next up, we're going to talk about Uricoma longifolia, otherwise known as longjack. And here we go again, another plant-based product that in studies can raise your blood testosterone levels, but yet again, when I go look at the actual numbers, I find an increase of less than 10% in all but one of the studies. Next up, we have horny goat weed, and the name sounds fun, and it does. It does sound fun. I'm going to admit that. And in studies on rodents, this ingredient seems to improve erectile function, but in the same studies, there was no change in blood testosterone level. And again, you are not a rat, so we don't know if this does anything for humans. Next up, we have cordyceps, and these are mushrooms that supposedly improve erectile function and boost testosterone. And yet again, the only studies that we have were done in diabetic rats. Next up, we have Tribulus terrestris, otherwise known as Bindi, and this is yet another plant marketed for boosting performance and increasing testosterone. And with this one, there are a few human studies that did show it increased blood testosterone levels, but there are also a few more that did not. So we have another substance with inconclusive results. We're almost done. Just hang in there. Next up, we have saw palmetto, and this is a plant ingredient that apparently inhibits the conversion of testosterone to DHT, which means that more testosterone will stay circulating in the bloodstream where it's free to build tissue. But yet again, these studies were done in rats, so we have no idea what this does in humans, if it does anything. All right, finally, we have turkesterone. And this substance has become very trendy over the past few years, with people like Andrew Huberman claiming it has stronger androgenic effects than even steroids. And as should be completely expected at this point, there are studies that indicate that it might be effective at increasing muscle strength and size, but these were only done in rats and no studies have been done on humans. So this one still might turn out to be good, but until there's a substantial volume of human studies, then we can't say that for sure, and it's not worth it. All right, so that was extremely tedious. I got through it pretty quickly, at least. But there are two more types of supplements I want to go over that we need to watch out for. The first one is fat burners. So these are any supplements that promise to do what the name suggests, increase the metabolism so that people can lose more weight than they would on their own. And these generally fall into two categories. The first category is ones that simply don't do much of anything, because when tested, these products at best burn like 50 extra extra calories in a day. So if we just do the math on that, it would take 70 days to lose just 1 pound of body fat from taking one of these products. And even a drug like clenbuterol, which is used by bodybuilders for fat loss, maybe only burns an extra 1 to 200 calories a day. So, and this is a heavy hitting drug that is taken by bodybuilders for serious results. So even taking a drug like this is only going, it's still going to take between 17 and 35 days to just lose 1 pound of fat. But the second category of products is the products that are contaminated and therefore potentially dangerous. In the meta review of products that the FDA received complaints about that I referenced before, the FDA found 264 products marketed for fat burning or weight loss that contained the drug sibutramine, which is banned in the U.S. for weight loss because it increases your risk of heart attack and other cardiac events. So a banned drug. Another study done on 110 random compounds purchased on the internet that found that a little over 10% of them contained one or two amphetamine-like chemicals, which the FDA has explicitly banned and have also been banned by the World Doping Agency. So when you're taking a fat burner, there's a 90% chance it does next to nothing and a 10% chance it's basically amphetamines. I don't like those odds, do you? All right, the last type of supplement we're going to talk about today is diuretics or water pills, and these are intended to reduce water retention in the body, and that water is then excreted out by the kidneys and out through the urine. And people often take these in combination with other measures such as limiting water intake, saunas, wearing a ton of heavy clothing to drop as much weight as quickly possible. And this is a big problem in any sport with a weight category. So combat sports, wrestling, weightlifting, bodybuilding, sports where somebody has to reach a certain weight in order to be able to compete with people around their same size. And in bodybuilding, diuretics are also used to give the body the tightest possible look. But using diuretics puts serious strain on your kidneys and creates an electrolyte imbalance that can lead to heart problems and sudden death. And a Washington Post report found at least 24 deaths in bodybuilding linked to diuretic usage, and many more incidents of lasting damage, including ulcers and kidney failure that required kidney transplants. And this is a much bigger conversation about these particular sports and how weight classes are handled. And just know for your own personal purposes that these diuretics are not something to fuck around with. All right, so let's wrap this all up here. And yet again, as I said before, I started writing the script and it just spiraled into weeks of research and one of my longest scripts yet. So thank you for bearing with me. So in conclusion, the supplement industry is wildly underregulated and people can essentially sell you whatever they want with no need to prove that their product is effective or even safe. And while this industry is begging for real, meaningful reform, I doubt that's ever going to happen given the financial power of the industry. So let's just leave you with some practical advice. First thing I'm going to say is try and get most of your nutrients from food directly. Unlike supplements, we have a ton of food safety and labeling standards that ensure that food is extremely safe and also that the food matches what's on the label. Beyond that, our bodies are used to food and want food. So eating real, minimally processed whole foods is always going to be what's best for your body. But beyond that, we can take some supplements when there's something we can't reasonably get from food like creatine or from something that you just can't consume enough of realistically or just don't want to, frankly. Second thing is to only take supplements that are well studied in humans and have conclusive evidence for effectiveness. If it's only been studied in rats or if the results in human tests have been inconclusive, then it's just not worth taking. And it is easy to take a, oh, what the hell attitude and assume the risks are low, but they're not nearly as low as they should be. Third thing, in any supplement you do take, you want to look for third-party testing. And this means a separate company tests a number of samples of the product and ensures that the ingredients match what's on the label, or you can look for DNA barcoding, like I talked about before. Common certifications you'll see on products are Safe Sports, NSF, BSGC, CL, and some other acronyms. Fucking love acronyms. Number four, you also want to look for products that follow GMP or good manufacturing practices. And this is a set of quality control procedures used in the pharmaceutical industry and is enforced by the FDA. And again, I said before, the FDA doesn't actually have an accurate index of how many manufacturers there are. So this is pretty much self-reported in the supplement industry, but I would argue that that's better than nothing, certainly. Finally, number five, finally and controversially, if you are looking to grow muscle beyond the few products I've outlined that actually work, creatine, caffeine, protein powder, carb powder, essential amino acids, you're certainly almost better taking nothing at all. But if you do feel the desire to take something, taking testosterone from a licensed provider is certainly safer and more effective because we have a ton of studies demonstrating that testosterone is both safe and effective. All right, that's it. Thank you for bearing with me and for letting me speed through a bunch of science really quickly. As always, I thank you for listening and thank you for bearing with my inconsistent upload schedule. I had initially said I wanted to do an episode every 2 weeks, but lately it's been more like every 3 weeks. And I don't know, I'm in kind of a place with this where I'm just not sure where I want to go with it, if I want to keep doing it for how long, etc. So we'll see. And per usual, I also will ask you to, if you like the show, give me a rating or review on whatever app you listen to us on. Also share the podcast with your friends. And finally, if you have a topic you want me to discuss, if you have any questions for me, or if you maybe want to come on the show and talk about something of interest to you, please feel free to email me at gaybrostuff@gmail.com. That is gaybrostuff@gmail.com. All right. Thank you, bros. Take it easy and put down the horny goat weed.
That's why we're living it up at the butt sex disco. Getting it on with all of my homos. Loving it up at the butt sex disco. Dancing around like I'm Yoko Ono. Queering it up at the butt sex disco. Spinning around to fend off my phone. Gain it up at the butt sex disco. Never go.